The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Orders of the day. Oral questions put by members. The time now is 3:17. We'll go to 4:47. I'll recognize the Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, while the addition of a child is an exciting time for families, many Nova Scotians are very concerned as a result of the H1N1 flu. Under the current immunization guidelines, children under 6 months of age cannot be vaccinated. When the government first announced plans for public vaccinations, new parents were encouraged to be vaccinated to protect the health of their babies. Yet under the revised priority list of this government, parents of children under the age of 6 months are excluded. So my question to the Minister of Health is, why has your government excluded parents of children under 6 months of age who cannot be immunized from your government's priority list for H1N1 vaccinations?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Honourable Member for the question. I know that parents who have wee ones under the age of 6 months would be very concerned, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the reason mums of very young infants and the infants cannot be vaccinated, the reason mums haven't been vaccinated is because they have antibodies that can be passed on to their infants, Mr. Speaker. I believe that is the answer, although I'm not a medical person. But, Mr. Speaker, I want to assure the Honourable Member that we are looking right now at the next tier of people who will get vaccinated. And what we will do for these families is a high priority and is utmost in our minds, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, new parents being of high priority in the Minister's mind is of little comfort to them as they fear for their children as we speak today. Speaker, I'm sure the Minister and Premier would understand the level of anxiety facing new parents in light of dangers involved with the H1N1 flu. Parents of children under 6 months include those who have premature babies, mothers who are breastfeeding, and children who remain in hospital due to health complications. Mr. Speaker, many parents were surprised to hear the Minister of Health state in the House yesterday that, quote, we are looking at who will get sickest if they get H1N1, and we are providing protection for those people first because we don't want people in our emergency rooms, in our ICUs for many, many weeks, end quote. My first supplementary to the Minister of Health, is it your government's position that premature babies and those under the age of 6 months are not in the category of those who would get sickest if they get H1N1.
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the sequencing for who would get the sickest if they have H1N1 flu is established by an arm's-length panel of medical experts, Mr. Speaker. They look at the medical information and the evidence, and they provide that to the chief medical officers of all of the provinces and to the federal government. We base our sequencing on the information they provide, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we know that the groups we have targeted first are the groups who would become very, very ill if they were to get H1N1. And, Mr. Speaker, we're very aware that there are other people, including infants, including children who have cancer over the age of five, And as we are able to extend the sequencing to other groups, which will be fairly soon, Mr. Speaker, we will be doing so.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that new parents throughout the province would share with me in the surprise of hearing the Minister of Health state that medical evidence is such that children under 6 months of age and premature children are not considered high risk when it comes to H1N1. Mr. Speaker, parents are very confused because when they see what's happening in New Brunswick and PEI, where they are considered to be a priority because of their newborn children, suddenly they are no longer a priority here in Nova Scotia. The minister stated yesterday, quote, "The vaccine we have has to go to people who will become the sickest if they get H1N1, and that is pregnant women, children under the age of 5, and residents of First Nation communities," end quote. Mr. Speaker, this excludes parents of premature babies, mothers who are breastfeeding new babies, and parents of children under the age of 6 months. So my final supplementary to the Minister of Health is, when will your government do the right thing and include parents of children under 6 months on the priority list for H1N1 vaccination in Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And as I said in my previous answer, Mr. Speaker, as long as our vaccine supply holds, and so far we are doing quite well, Mr. Speaker, in that regard, we feel confident that we are going to be able to extend the vaccine to other groups. And, Mr. Speaker, this group will be under active consideration in the sequencing order according to the medical advice we are getting. Mr. Speaker, I also want to indicate that I had a conversation with the Minister of Health in New Brunswick, and unfortunately that province are facing no vaccine, Mr. Speaker, for still a considerable number of their high-risk population.
The Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question through you is to the Premier. Now, Mr. Premier, the Minister of Health stated yesterday that she had not received information from DHAs, so she does not know how many health care workers have received the vaccine or how many more still need it. My question to the Premier is this. Would he please find out and share with Nova Scotians when the Minister of Health made the request to the DHAs regarding the number of health care workers who had received the vaccine, and by what date that information should have been shared?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What I can share with the Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party is that conversation with respect to the immunization program for health care workers is an ongoing one. In fact, that information is requested. The information and data that is available is shared on a daily basis.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Without knowing how many health care workers have received the vaccine, and without knowing how many more need the vaccine, how can this minister implement her new plan to immunize a second priority group when she does not know how much demand there still exists in the first group?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I pointed out, that information is being held in the district health authorities. They are transmitting it to us. We are following that data. For the Leader of the Progressive Conservatives information, I can tell them that more than 15,000 health care workers have been immunized already. That's more than 55%. One of the obvious questions is, where in the health care paradigm are those workers? Are they frontline? Are they on administrative staff? Those are legitimate questions. Of course, we're following this closely so that we make sure we have an accurate picture of how the immunization of healthcare workers in the province is going.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party in your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And perhaps I could ask the Minister to table that information prior to the closing of the House this session. My last question is, it is a lack of planning a lack of using important data, and lack of managing supply that has created frustration, confusion, and anger among Nova Scotians regarding the H1N1 crisis. My question to the Premier is this. Will he, as a leader of this province, apologize to Nova Scotians for the lack of leadership shown in dealing with this file and this crisis?
The Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think it's my place to apologize on behalf of the former government. I don't know what we're doing here, and what we're doing here, Mr. Speaker, is making sure that we're conducting the largest immunization program in the history of the province that is being administered, I believe, in a forthright fashion. And in fact, the Minister of Health and healthcare workers across the province should be congratulated for the work they're doing.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Premier. Mr. Speaker, last week the Premier stated that he had asked the federal government to help fund two public-private partnerships in Nova Scotia. But in the past, Mr. Speaker, the Premier and his party have endlessly criticized these agreements. So, Mr. Speaker, I think this House and all Nova Scotians need some clarification from the Premier. So my question to the Premier, exactly what is your position on public-private partnerships?
The Honourable the Premier.
In fact, Mr. Speaker, I've said for many years that public-private partnerships are a misnomer, that the government enters into public-private partnerships almost every day. We don't run construction companies. We don't have building companies. What we do is we provide them with a set of specifications. They make a bid on a project. We choose the best tender. So those are always underway in this province, always have been, Mr. Speaker. I expect likely they always will be.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your first supplementary.
It continues, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in the spring of 2008, our current Premier said he planned to reintroduce an amendment to the Auditor General's Act, requiring the province to audit and perform a cost-benefit analysis of all P3 projects valued at more than $5 million. Mr. Speaker, the Premier didn't introduce the amendment in the spring of 2008, and he didn't introduce the amendment in the fall of 2008 either, and he hasn't introduced the amendment since becoming Premier. So my question to the Premier is, if the provisions around P3 financing were so important to you and this amendment was so critical, why have you neglected to introduce it since becoming Premier?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think it's a very straightforward answer. Now that we're a government, we don't have to worry about it. We simply won't do it.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure all Nova Scotians are reassured by the fact that he says we won't do it, Mr. Speaker. It's just another example of the NDP saying one thing in opposition and doing quite another in government. Now we hear, Mr. Speaker, that QP is going to fight government on this matter because they don't think it's a good idea. Mr. Speaker, it's time for the Premier to own up to his past comments, stop the hypocrisy, and be forthright with Nova Scotians. So my final question for the Premier is, are you going to allow QP to dictate the direction for Nova Scotia, or will you as Premier handle the file on P3s?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, none of those choices are logical or reasonable. What we intend to do is conduct business on behalf of the province of Nova Scotia in the best interests of the people of this province. That's why we got elected. That's what we will do.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is also for the Premier. Yesterday, the government passed legislation to administer the demand-side management charges paid by consumers through higher power bills. However, Mr. Speaker, the Premier's Chief of Staff made a submission to the URB in June 2009 claiming a rate charge to Nova Scotia power customers would be ill-advised. And to quote from that, Mr. Speaker, it would, quote, place a surcharge on their power bills at this juncture, which would add unneeded and counterproductive costs to residential and business users. Yesterday, the Premier's Chief of Staff spent more time than I've ever seen him in this building trying to downplay the importance of that submission to the media. So, Mr. Speaker, I want to know if the Premier still believes, as stated in the NDP Review Board submission, that power customers should not pay DSM surcharges on their bills in January.
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I believe it was a well-reasoned and well-thought-out brief at the time. I have to say, though, the UARB made their decision, and we're not going to interfere with the decision of the UARB. As he knows, the Utility Review Board is an arm's-length organization set out to consider these matters. They heard all the briefs. They made a decision. We're acting to make sure that through a demand-side management program that these funds are in fact administered to the greatest benefit of the people of the province.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, this Premier had options. This Premier had a choice, and the choice he made was to raise Nova Scotians' power bills on January 1st. This at a time when customers in New Brunswick are seeing their rates frozen and in some cases decreased. This is completely the opposite of what the Premier said in June. 4 days before the election, the Premier said, and I quote, "This is the wrong time to impose a rate surcharge for the next 3 years. The bottom line is affordability." Mr. Speaker, this government had options, and the people that are in backbenches now stated when they were in opposition many times that they would be willing in government to overrule the Utility and Review Board. So, Mr. Speaker, I want the Premier to answer why, since the DSM charge wouldn't even exist until January, why he didn't instruct his Minister of Energy to craft legislation which would live up to your election position and not charge customers this fee.
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And as I just pointed out to the member opposite, the Utility and Review Board is an arm's-length board. They made a decision. They weighed out the benefits to the people of the province. They came to a conclusion. Whether I agree with it or not, I respect the decision of the Utility and Review Board.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the Premier knows full well that the Utility and Review Board operates under whatever provincial legislation exists and interprets it and operates at arm's length only to interpret that legislation. Mr. Speaker, obviously the submission to the Review Board was made solely for political purposes, and the NDP had no intention of moving on this. The NDP had every reason at that point in June to know that they would become government 4 days later. And they would have the power to make whatever changes that they wanted to surcharges. So the Premier, and thankfully, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad to hear that the government agrees with me. Mr. Speaker, the Premier knows that the URB makes led decisions within the context of provincial legislation. And it's funny how during the press briefing on this bill, the Minister of Energy forgot to mention that power bills will go up. So, Mr. Premier, will you now admit that your party wrote the Utility and Review Board on this issue without any intent of ever fixing this when you became government?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd certainly like to begin by thanking the member opposite for an endorsement of the good sense of the people of Nova Scotia. What I can say to him is that during the election campaign, we made a decision that we would commit to a reduction with respect to the HST on electricity. We introduced it, and we completed it just as we promised.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question through you is to the Minister of Health. Mr. Speaker, it's bad enough the NDP have botched delivery of the H1N1 vaccine through the knee-jerk reactions and management by the moment. They've deviated time and time again from what they stated short weeks ago with confidence. Obviously, more time has been spent patting themselves on the back than putting pen to paper for a real plan that Nova Scotians could have confidence in. Now it extends to the regular administration of flu shots across Nova Scotia. Will the Minister inform this House whether or not the NDP botching of the H1N1 vaccine is affecting distribution of regular flu shots as well?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the regular flu shots are going ahead as planned, Mr. Speaker. In fact, on the Thanksgiving weekend when I was home in Antigonish County visiting my parents, who are in their late 70s, early 80s, sorry, Mom, I took note that flu clinics were happening throughout Antigonish County for people for the regular influenza, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North on your first supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Minister's answer does not address the current day reality in other places in Nova Scotia. General practitioners who are looking for regular flu vaccines are being denied access to the full supply. Last year, when their orders of 800-plus doses were filled, now this year the Department of Health is restricting that supply to 80 to 100 at a time. Again, can the minister explain why doctors are being told to pick and choose who is worthy of a flu shot or not?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I'm really not sure where the Honourable Member is getting his information, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, doctors throughout the province, in fact, are getting vaccine for influenza, for regular influenza, Mr. Speaker, and many of them are administering the influenza vaccine to their patients, and additionally, there have been the regular influenza clinics prior to the prior to H1N1 becoming an issue, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North on your final supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And while I appreciate it's important for her parents to get their shots at a clinic, I do understand that there's Nova Scotians that are not getting their shots. The doctors have been restricted the supply. We're asking for week after week with no full supply provided. Mr. Speaker, seniors are especially worried about the now two strains of the flu. Being denied access to a regular flu shot while the NDP scramble to determine their thought du jour is not acceptable. The minister knows that the flu can be a killer for seniors, yet her government and officials are not responding adequately. Will the minister detail why her government has been restricting the supply from the department of regular flu shots, especially for seniors in parts of this province?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, first of all, I didn't say my parents got the flu shots, Mr. Speaker. I said I noted when I was visiting in Antigonish County, there were clinics advertised around the Thanksgiving time, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the influenza shot is still recommended for people over the age of 65, Mr. Speaker, and it's recommended for them because it's believed that they have the greatest degree of immunity to the H1N1 virus, but still we feel that seniors over 65 need to have the regular flu shots. And Mr. Speaker, many seniors have already had those shots, and those shots will continue to be available, Mr. Speaker, throughout the province in doctors' offices and at clinics. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax, Clayton Park.
Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Health. As we are all aware, this government made a commitment to make emergency rooms, and the emergency room in particular at the Cobequid Community Health Centre, a 24/7 operation. While this promise may be popular with the public, we learned today during public accounts it may not be all that practical. Given the Minister's stated commitment to evidence-based decision-making, my question to the Minister is, will the Cobequid ER become a 24/7 operation if the evidence and recommendations don't support that decision?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this government came into office knowing that we had very serious difficulties in our emergency rooms, both here in the Capital District and around the province, especially in rural communities. Mr. Speaker, we have a plan. We made a commitment to hire an emergency room advisor in the current year. We moved quickly to put that in place. We're very pleased that Dr. John Ross is on the job. Mr. Speaker, we are in the process of moving forward with other aspects of our plan, which we committed to for the coming year, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax, Clayton Park, on your first supplementary.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, we learned today that the development of an inpatient unit would be almost necessary if we were to move towards a 24/7 operation at Cobequid. We also learned that the District Health Authority and their business planning process were recommending an expansion in operating hours for the Cobequid, but not necessarily a 24/7 operation. Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House are most concerned about how we spend our limited financial resources. And most importantly, we don't want to see another 24/7 operation plagued with frequent closures. My question to the Minister is, given the mixed messages received today between the promises and the expectations, perhaps the evidence, could the Minister please indicate whether she has a report within her department that contradicts government's promise to make Cobequid a 24/7 operation?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this government came into office and made a commitment that we would deal with emergency departments, Mr. Speaker. Part of our planning process is to evaluate where the situation is as it currently stands, Mr. Speaker. We're not particularly interested in looking back on the 10 failed years of the former government and any reports that they might have commissioned with respect to emergency rooms, Mr. Speaker. Their policy was obviously quite different than our policy. Their policy was not one to deal with emergency room closures, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member of Halifax, Clayton Park, on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I hear the Minister saying that they made a commitment or a promise, she said, to deal with ERs, and that's true. But the fact of the matter was the detail said to keep all the ERs open and in the Sackville area to open up the Cobequid Centre 24/7. And that's quite different from what we're hearing today, where we hear that John Ross, our new emergency room advisor, will come back with something in a year's time. The question today to the Minister is, will she abide by other recommendations aside from the 24/7 opening of all emergency rooms and the opening of the Cobequid Centre 24/7. I'm hearing her say she's going to listen to Dr. Ross. I want to know whether everything is open for discussion and that promise is open for discussion.
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't know what more the Honourable Member wants. Mr. Speaker, this party ran on a commitment to deal with the problems in the emergency departments around the province, Mr. Speaker. And we laid out during the election campaign the elements that we felt would address many of the difficulties in our emergency department. We have already completed some of those elements, Mr. Speaker, and we are proceeding to complete other elements of that plan. And the details of that will be made known to the member and other members as they are achieved, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Argyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Health Promotion and Protection. It's been 3 months from the time the Auditor General's report on pandemic preparedness was issued to the time that the H1N1 vaccine started to be administered in Nova Scotia. Yet the aspects that were raised by the Auditor General seem to have underlying problems with the government's H1N1 plan. Mr. Speaker, my questions are to the Minister. You've had the Auditor General's report since July, but the recommendations to improve the H1N1 preparedness plan have not been heeded. What aspects of the Auditor General's report have this government actually implemented?
The Honourable Minister of Health Promotion and Protection.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, there really isn't enough time left in question period to outline all of the recommendations that we've completed out of the Auditor General's. Mr. Speaker, there were 33 recommendations out of the Auditor General's report. Mr. Speaker, not all of those recommendations were applicable to the Department of Health or the Department of Health and Promotion and Protection. But a large number of them were, Mr. Speaker, and we have achieved practically all of the recommendations that have been made by the Auditor General. We signed the Good Neighbor Protocol, Mr. Speaker. We ordered the supplies, Mr. Speaker. We're in the process of filling the epidemiologist position and the other officers of medical information in the DHAs, Mr. Speaker. We have allocated additional resources for pandemic, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we have, unlike that former government, whose plan was criticized by the Auditor General, taken action, immediate action, and, Mr. Speaker, soon I will report to the Auditor General the progress, the considerable progress we have made with respect to his recommendations.
The Honourable Member for Argyll on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I thoroughly enjoyed the non-answer from the Minister there. The only answer that she can come up with these days is, well, you guys didn't do it, or you guys didn't do it. But, Mr. Speaker, Nova Scotians are getting tired of the funny smirks and the blame game that continues to go on by this government. It's time that they become the government. Time they become the government, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we know that there needs to be a risk assessment done when any plan is put in place. That was one of the main recommendations of the AG's report. In that plan, you would know that your supply of vaccine, the priority groups, how it can be administered effectively with the resources available, along with a host of other critical questions. My question through you to the Minister of Health, did you perform a risk assessment as recommended by the Auditor General and ask the critical questions of your vaccination plan?
Of course you wouldn't. The Honourable Minister of Health, Promotion and Protection.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, I know the Honourable Member probably won't understand the response to this question. Given that the plan that was being worked on was part of the process for...
Order, please. Order. The Honourable Minister of Health has the question. The Honourable Minister of Health. Come on. The Honourable Minister of Health. Now, Minister, Honourable Minister, Member, I'm asking for the Minister of Health has the floor. Okay. The Honourable Minister of Health. The Honourable Member. Okay, the Honourable Member for Argyll on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I'll let her try to answer the question. Let me see if she can answer the question like a responsible minister that's responsible for the Department of Health, that people are asking questions about H1N1 and wondering if she's followed the recommendations from the Auditor General's report. Did they follow a risk assessment when it came to putting together the pandemic plan for H1N1?
The Honourable Minister of Health, Promotion and Protection.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Auditor General made 33 recommendations. Many of them applied to the Department of Health. Mr. Speaker, we have implemented most of those recommendations, and we are working on the others that we haven't fully implemented, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the risk assessment is a exercise that you do prior to a pandemic occurring, Mr. Speaker. Unfortunately, this pandemic has occurred before any further work on the pandemic plan was possible, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. The Honourable Member for Bedford, Birch Cove.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister responsible for the status of women. Recently, the report on the Domestic Violence Prevention Committee was posted to the Department of Justice website. The government has not addressed this report and has not tabled it in the House, despite promising to respond to it during the speech from the throne. Mr. Speaker, the first recommendation of the report was, and I'm quoting, to develop, in collaboration with the community, a domestic violence prevention strategy for Nova Scotia, end quote. And since I'm quoting from a report the government hasn't tabled yet, I'll table it in its entirety for the House. My question to the minister. As the minister responsible for the status of women, are you working with your government to develop a domestic violence prevention strategy, yes or no?
The Honourable Minister responsible for the status of women.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the Honourable Member for her question. I know it's an issue that is concerning to her, and it's an issue concerning to me and the staff of the status of women. And yes, we are going forward, and we do have a plan and a consultation process to look at the whole entire issue of domestic violence against women.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. According to the report, an estimated 21,000 Nova Scotia women were victims of domestic violence between 1999 and 2004. 91% of domestic violence victims are women. Yet during estimates, the Justice Minister cautioned us about where we genderize the issue. Now, with 91% of victims being women, and with the Justice Minister reluctant to deal with this issue from a gender perspective, you can see why it's important for the Minister responsible for the status of women to be involved with the implementation of this report. My question to the Minister responsible, will she outline the specific steps she has taken to address domestic violence?
The Honourable Minister responsible for the status of women.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think one of the first steps that we were able to do through actually community services was the fact of pushing up the funding to the transition houses of $500,000, which is the first time that has been done over 10 years. The former government did not move on it at all. We became government and we moved on it. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's clear the report of Domestic Violence Committee understands that women and children are most often the victims of domestic violence. One of the recommendations made by the report was to establish men's intervention programs. My colleague from Halifax, Clayton Park, brought up the recommendation for men's intervention programs during the estimates, but the Justice Minister did not address the issue. My question to the Minister responsible, are you committed to implementing the recommendations of the report in their entirety, including a men's intervention program?
The Honourable Minister responsible for the status of women.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the Honourable Member. One thing that's very important to know is, yes, we take the recommendations, we look at what's in the recommendations, and as a new government, then we need the opportunity to discuss that further along with all those key players that are involved. It is vitally important for us to go forward, and we do not work in a silo in this government. We work with all the other different departments, and that's exactly what we are doing, have been doing, and will be doing. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question through you is to the Premier. Today, in a bill briefing on personal health information legislation, the Minister of Health admitted that keeping emergency rooms open was, quote, a bold promise, and that the NDP was merely making a campaign commitment to make Nova Scotians feel secure. My question to the Premier, as I table some documents, the first page of one of those I would like to read, Nova Scotia's New Democrats say that they will keep emergency hospital departments open if elected. My question to the Premier is this. In light of the Minister of Health's bold and revealing comments today, are you telling Nova Scotians that your government is about to break another election promise, that being to keep emergency rooms open 24/7?
Take that quick, say yes.
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I think the Minister of Health was absolutely correct when she said it was a bold promise. It was one that recognized the importance of emergency rooms in this province as part of the health infrastructure. And, of course, like all the other commitments that we have kept, we're going to work on keeping this one as well.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Did I hear an almost all or just all? Yes. Mr. Speaker, the Minister has repeatedly said, and in response to questions about keeping ERs open, and I quote, I'm not prepared to say. This seems to be always the Minister's fallback statement. Nova Scotians are paying the price of having a Minister who just does not know the answers to important questions. We have seen this recently yesterday and today and in every question in this House. So my question to the Premier is, what is your Minister hiding from Nova Scotians about your plan to keep emergency rooms open?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Far from hiding it, we're actually demonstrating the implementation of that plan. We've hired the emergency room advisor. We've introduced legislation that demands consultation by the district health authorities with respect to emergency services, Mr. Speaker. We've done more in the few months that we've been here than that government did in 10 years.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your final supplementary.
Deficit, Darrell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Deficit.
At the end of the day, this government obviously does not have a plan in place for quality health care. In fact, Barbara Hall, Vice President of Capital District Health Authority today, is now questioning the NDP's promise to keep ERs open 24/7. And the Deputy Minister of Health, in his own words today, said, and I quote, the NDP government won't be able to keep that promise, end of quote. The final question for the Premier is this. Will you commit to keeping emergency rooms open 24/7 as you promised Nova Scotians during your election campaign?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What you can be assured of is that we are working to make sure that we implement all of the promises we made.
The Honourable Leader, no, the Honourable Member for Halifax Clayton Park.
Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Health. Yesterday in question period, we had a number of questions about the under-resourced mental health system in this province. We heard the Premier state that there has been, and I quote, a negotiated agreement with psychiatrists and that it is in the process of being approved over the next week or so, unquote. Mr. Speaker, the Minister of Health then indicated to media that this is not her priority and not something she will be looking at in the next 10 days. My question to the Minister, will you ensure that a contract is signed with psychiatrists in the next week or so, as per the Premier's promise, yes or no?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the former government negotiated an MOU with the psychiatrists at the School of Medicine at Dalhousie, Mr. Speaker. Although that that MOU was never formally signed or authorized by the Cabinet. But it was understood that it was an agreement between the parties, Mr. Speaker. And, Mr. Speaker, we will uphold the terms of that MOU, which include a provision to negotiate an AFP, Mr. Speaker. And so when the Premier said yesterday that we would uphold the MOU, he was correct. We will, in fact, do that. And that includes having to negotiate an AFP, Mr. Speaker. But the negotiating of the AFP will not happen overnight.
The Honourable Member for Halifax Clayton Park on your first supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I'm disappointed to hear that we won't have an agreement signed within the next week or so. I think it is an important issue for this province on a number of fronts. And you can't ignore one problem simply because you have a lot of other issues on your plate. Psychiatrists are leaving this province, and that's a challenge. Mr. Speaker, it's a challenge that the government should not be ignoring. The Minister of Health yesterday indicated that departmental officials are putting together a mental health strategy as well. My question to the Minister is, who has the Minister consulted in order to develop this mental health strategy?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, it's very true that in the Department of Health, we don't have the luxury of doing one thing and then moving on to the next thing. We have to do many things at a time, Mr. Speaker. But, Mr. Speaker, many of the health care unions have indicated that they are prepared to pull back from collective bargaining to allow the department ample time to deal with the H1N1 difficulty. And, Mr. Speaker, that's all I was asking for as well with this particular group of psychiatrists with respect to their AFP. Mr. Speaker, we will get to it as soon as we can, and we ask for their patience. We do value the services they provide, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax, Clayton Park, on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I appreciate what the Minister is saying, but yesterday we had seven psychiatrists who took time out of their busy days and out of the pressures they're under to come here and ask the Minister to move on signing a contract with them. Part of their fear is the loss of their colleagues as they leave the province, as they are not available to help in what is becoming an increasingly difficult situation. And so what I'm asking, and the Minister has said that that they already have an agreement in place, that there's an MOU that you're abiding by, so why not sign the contract and put their fears to rest? And that is my question to the Minister right now. Why don't you sign that contract and simply set this aside so that people can get on with business?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I said, we will be negotiating the terms of the AFP, which is one of the provisions of the Memorandum of Understanding, as soon as we can get to it, Mr. Speaker, within the existing staff resources allocated to the pressing issues that are facing us in the Department of Health with H1N1, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question through you is to the Premier. Mr. Speaker, on September the 22nd, Resolution Number 110 on the Duncan Mine was given unanimous consent of this House, and the operative clause was, therefore, be it resolved that this government give their support to this project so Nova Scotians can enjoy electric heat generated by Cape Breton coal, end of quote. My question to the Premier is this. What has the Premier and his government done since taking office to help move this project ahead?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Speaker. It's a project that, of course, all of the parties in this House, I think, would be interested in. I've paid careful attention to it since I have come into office, making sure that I keep up to date on Xstrata's plans. There is a constant flow of information going back and forth between the project proponents and the government. Of course, this is a project that really has to work for everyone. So we're very cognizant of where they are. They are very cognizant of the programs that are available through government to provide assistance. All I can say about it is it's under consideration and negotiation.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Premier for that answer. As the Premier is aware, the province of Nova Scotia is making great strides towards green energy, and everybody in this House is very supportive of that. But the Premier should also be aware that 70% of the electricity generated in Nova Scotia comes from coal-fired generation plants. Of that coal-fired generation plant, it burns about 3 million tonnes of coal a year. Only 800,000 tonnes come from Nova Scotia. So this project, in its exploratory stage, would have an ability to give Nova Scotians from across the province stable power rates, buying coal in Nova Scotia in the same currency, and, of course, creating jobs. My question is I'm also told that during the exploratory stage, Mr. Speaker, that it's $110 million that will be spent in capital and $45 million in operating costs. My question to the Premier is this. Can he tell the residents of Duncan and surrounding area what he and his government plan to do to make sure that this initial investment is not lost to Nova Scotian workers?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member opposite for the question. I'm sure he's aware that not only am I well aware of the details of this plan, I've actually been down in the mine. I went there because I'm very interested in this project. But you have to understand that it is a business proposal. It is a project and a proponent that is coming forward with a project for which the government will have to be responsible for certain aspects of it. So, we're considering it. I think if you talk to the proponent, they will find that our offices have been open to them. We've been clear with our advice to them. We have looked and are continuing to work with them in terms of the flow of information that they need in order to be able to move the project forward. And Mr. Speaker, that's where it is. This is a business deal. This is a project that needs to go forward and to satisfy a range of interests, including the economic ones.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Premier. And I would say through you to the Premier that I'm well aware of the proponents of the project. I speak to them on a regular basis. I'm familiar with the Donkin coal because I was actually worked in the lab that did the processing on that coal when it was first mined. At the end of the day, this project has a significant impact on all of Nova Scotia, certainly environmental and for electrical purposes. Mr. Premier, are you prepared to take the steps needed to allow Nova Scotia Power to burn Donkin coal during the four-year exploratory stage and open the door for hundreds of millions of dollars of investment into our province?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. As you may know, the question of whether or not there's a contract between Nova Scotia Power and Xstrata is a matter of the private business relationships between those companies. What I can tell him, Mr. Speaker, is I'm well aware of the importance of the project, both to his district, surrounding area and to the province as a whole. So we're well aware of it. We are communicating with the company. We've told them, given the benefit of the advice that we can on the project. They have to make certain assessments as well, many of which are on an economic basis. And of course, we're going to respect that. So at this point, there's nothing for me to report on the project except to say that information continues to flow between the government and Xstrata as the proponent. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Department of Health commissioned the operational audit of the Richmond County Home Support Services Society, which operates home care services in Richmond County. The report was done by MMC Consulting and is dated December 1, 2008. The report highlights a number of deficiencies in the operation of the Home Support Society and finds that client service has been negatively impacted as a result. The report concludes that the current society, which is made up of a volunteer board, must dismiss the executive director. If they refuse to do so, the report recommends that the minister replace the Richmond County Home Support Services Society with an alternate agency. Now, my question to the Minister of Health is, what steps are you prepared to take to implement the findings of the operational audit for the Richmond County Home Support Services Society?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Honourable Member for the question. Mr. Speaker, the board of the Richmond County Home Support Services have approached the department with a request for a meeting with myself, and Mr. Speaker, that meeting is scheduled for Friday here in Halifax, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member from Richmond on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the volunteer board of the Richmond County Home Support Services Society has so far refused to dismiss the executive director, as the minister is well aware, even following threats from the Department of Health to cut off their funding. Meanwhile, unionized staff continue to work in a poisoned environment, and families have not had their concerns over decisions made by the executive director addressed. The report found that Department of Health data indicates that while Richmond County has the highest per capita wait list for long-term care beds, it also has the lowest rate of home care service. It is clear that families are not getting the home care services they should be receiving, and the report lays the blame squarely on the executive director. So my question to the minister, now that you've indicated you will be meeting with the board on Friday, is the minister prepared to enforce the findings of the operational audit when she meets with the board on Friday?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it's my intention when I meet with the board on Friday to discuss the deficiencies that were laid out in the auditing statement. And beyond that, Mr. Speaker, I'm reserving my judgment in terms of what the conclusion of that meeting will mean, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member from Richmond on your final supplementary.
Speaker, one of the issues is that the audit called upon the board, which is made up of volunteers, they're just ordinary residents of Richmond County, and told them they had to fire the executive director. Naturally, they're concerned about the legal implications on them personally as volunteers. The minister knows that. So the time has gone by for the minister to reserve judgment on what the meeting outcome is going to be. The board is basically looking for the Department of Health to themselves take the legal responsibility of firing the executive director and take that burden away from them. This is, again, similar to the issue in Digby with the nurse practitioner, where Nova Scotians are looking for the minister to provide leadership, leadership which she already knows has been given to her as a mandate through the findings of the operational audit. So on behalf of the residents of Richmond County, will the minister commit today that if the board does not fire the executive director on its own, either the Department of Health will do it for them, or in the alternative, will replace the board with a new agency in Richmond County to ensure home care services for our residents?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as I said, I will meet with the members of this Board of Directors on Friday, Mr. Speaker. I will discuss the findings of the audit and the deficiencies in the audit. And beyond that, Mr. Speaker, I think I will reserve my judgment, and my decision will certainly be made known in the near future, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cumberland South.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and through you, Mr. Speaker, to the Premier. Contrary to statements that were made during a recent election campaign by the Premier, it seems that the Minister of Health now is bringing into question the future of ERs in Nova Scotia. So I would simply ask the Premier today, who should Nova Scotians listen to, statements by the Premier or by his Minister of Health?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Minister of Health, I think, accurately sets out exactly what the agenda of the government is. She has been proceeding with the plan. She's hired the ER advisor. She's made sure that they have implemented or brought forward the legislation with respect to accountability. These are measures that are designed to actually implement the commitments we made. I know that makes the member unhappy.
The Honourable Member for Cumberland South and your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And to the Premier, what would make this member happy, and I'm sure all people in Nova Scotia happy, is a commitment from him to keep his word that he gave during the election campaign. Mr. Speaker, on the table, a couple of documents here. The first one is from the Cape Breton Post, dated May 14th. It says, hospital emergency rooms will stay open more under an NDP government, Dexter said. Second one, Cape Breton Post, May 30th. Dexter later clarified by saying that as Premier, he would, and I'll quote, accept the responsibility to make sure that those ERs are open. Mr. Speaker, I'm asking the Premier today, contrary to what the staff of the department have said this morning, that he would, as he stated during the campaign, accept the responsibility, in his words, to make sure that those ERs are open. And that means across Nova Scotia, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, I want to thank the member opposite for bringing forward those campaign news reports and point out to him that this is exactly what we're doing. We're taking responsibility. We're taking steps to make sure that we're able to provide services in those communities for years that have not had, you know, adequate emergency services. Is it going to be resolved overnight? We never said that. What we did say is that it's time to make sure that we have a plan to implement that delivers services, health care services to the people of this province. It is what we're doing.
The Honourable Member from Cumberland South on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, again, through you to the Premier, I'd suggest the Premier look at statements that have been made today, both publicly and outside of this House, in regards to officials from the Department of Health about that very issue. He may want to look at that, Mr. Speaker, and rethink about what's being said here today as well. Mr. Speaker, the Department of Health has provided additional funding in Cumberland County for ERs in Pugwash and Parsville. And my understanding is that will continue to January 2010. I want to ask the Premier today if he will commit to ensuring that money stays in place and that those ERs will not close.
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. The reason why we have a Department of Health and a minister and a plan for all of this is to make sure that services, just like the ones that you've outlined, are able to continue to be offered to the citizens of your communities and, in fact, communities right across the province. The planning process, the work of the minister, the work of the department will continue, and as I've pointed out earlier, I don't believe there's any contradiction between what I've been saying and what the Minister of Health is saying. In fact, I think we're saying exactly the same thing, is that we truly want the best possible health service for the people of the province.
The Honourable Member for Digby Annapolis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Premier. Yesterday, it was announced that the emergency department at Digby General Hospital will be closed every Monday and Wednesday in November because of a doctor shortage. Healthcare access in Digby has already been compromised as a result of firing a very capable nurse practitioner that we have to deal with. And now we have to deal with ER closures on top of this. So my question to our Premier, why isn't this government providing accessible health care to the people of Digby, Digby Neck and Islands?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you. I want to thank the member opposite for the question. I know that the situation that his constituents face are not the best circumstances that we can find the province, but this, as he knows, goes back a long way. And the department, the minister, and departmental staff are doing what we can do in order to address the shortages that you point out. As I pointed out before, this is not the kind of thing that's going to be resolved in every community overnight. What you need to know, though, is that there is a plan, that the advisor is in place, that the departmental staff are aware of the challenges that are there. They are doing the appropriate consultations to try and make sure that we're able to provide the services that your community needs.
The Honourable Member for Digby Annapolis on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, today in public accounts, my colleague from Halifax Clayton Park questioned the Department of Health official about the Corpus Sanchez report. What was meant by a shared service model for the Annapolis and the Digby ERs? The official replied that the shared service model may allow one of the two ERs in the region to remain open full-time. It is possible that one of these ERs will be kept open at the expense of the other. So my question to the Minister of Health, will she accept a recommendation from the Southwest District Health Authority that would see the ER at Digby General reduced to something less than the 24/7?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the member for the question. Mr. Speaker, as the Premier indicated, we are very aware of the challenges that have existed in this area of the province for a considerable period of time. Mr. Speaker, we have encouraged, with the advice from the District Health Authorities, that they look at various ways, various models of providing services to meet the needs of the population. But, Mr. Speaker, in no way are we going down the road to close emergency rooms in the Annapolis Valley or in the Digby area, Mr. Speaker. Our objective is to provide good emergency room services in that honorable member's community and in the surrounding communities, Mr. Speaker.
The honorable member for Digby Annapolis on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, this government's lack of action leads us to believe that it's not concerned about the well-being of the people of Digby, Digby Neck, and Islands. The Minister of Health should prove this isn't the case by meeting with the people of this area and taking meaningful action to improve health care accessibility in that area. So my question to the Minister of Health is, will the Minister commit to personally hold a public meeting in Digby this month to address the concerns regarding the accessibility to health and the nurse practitioner that's being fired?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Member knows, last week I met with the Warden for the area and other concerned citizens from the area, Mr. Speaker, who have been involved with the liaison committee between the community's clinic and the District Health Authority. Mr. Speaker, it is my intention to visit various parts of the province to meet with healthcare providers, to look at and learn more about the issues that I and my department are expected to be working on, Mr. Speaker. And, Mr. Speaker, that schedule will very much be dependent on the amount of time I have to put in with respect to dealing with the H1N1 pandemic situation. But I want to assure the Honourable Member that in the not-so-distant future, I will be making a visit to his community, and I'll advise him of when I'm in the area, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Victoria the Lakes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question through you is for the Minister of Service, Nova Scotia Municipal Relations. Mr. Speaker, the legal community, as well as the municipality of the County of Victoria, are quite concerned about the loss of the mapper position for the Victoria County Land Registry Office. Last Friday was the final day for Mr. Lockie McLean, who retired after many years of service. My question to the Minister, is the Minister able to confirm if this position will be advertised and a replacement name for Bedeck in Victoria County?
The Honourable Minister of Service, Nova Scotia Municipal Relations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the question. I would, before I answer the question, I would like to say that I appreciate receiving this question today, but if any citizens or any group in Nova Scotia would like an answer from me on any issue, they can contact my office directly or with the staff. I will assure you that there will be the required mapping services at Victoria Land Registration Office. At this time, there is an electronic system in Nova Scotia. So across the 18 different land registration places, we'll be able to make sure that there's services are provided so that there's not too much at one, that they're being able to be distributed evenly across the province. I would like to make sure that you understand that there will be no loss of staff at the Victoria Land Registration Office. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Victoria the Lakes on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to hear that, provided that the job in Victoria County will be a five-day-a-week job that will stay in Victoria County. Mr. Speaker, the Municipality of Victoria is very concerned that the loss of services and the loss of employment in small communities like Bedeck will have a drastic negative effect on the viabilities of small communities in Victoria County. And the Minister has explained the rationale about the computerized systems and everything else, but I'd ask the Minister if she could explain the rationale as it stands right now in making the people in Victoria County use the Sydney Land Office.
The Honourable Minister of Service, Nova Scotia and Municipal Relations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. There are full services at the Victoria County Land Registry Office. If the mapping, there will be, as required, the mapping person will be there. I don't understand where this information is coming from. The service is being offered through that office, and I would like to say that we too, this government, is very, very dedicated to making sure that our staff across the province stay in place and that we make sure that our smaller communities are retaining their staff. So thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Victoria of the Lakes on your final supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and it's certainly pleasing to hear that the service will be there, but I think the understanding is it might only be a couple of days a week, which would be a hardship to anyone that's having work done by the legal community or the municipality. Mr. Speaker, the Minister might have received this letter. If not, I will table it, but the municipality of the County of Victoria wrote a letter asking for a meeting to discuss this issue of the mapper remained in Impedec, and I'm just asking her, would she agree to meet with the Municipal Council as soon as possible?
The Honourable Minister of Service, Nova Scotia and Municipal Relations.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. No, I have not received that letter, but I also want to repeat that if any group or if any citizen needs to meet with me on any of the issues around Service Nova Scotia or Municipal Relations, I definitely will meet with them. So, yes, I will meet with them as soon as my schedule allows. And I just also want to say that to assure you that the staff at the Land Registry Office will be remain in place. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Preston.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Education. For years, there has been promises of a new school in Porter's Lake. On April 18, 2008, the former government announced it would invest $10.4 million to replace Lakeview Consolidated Elementary School in Porter's Lake. The school was expected in September 2010, but there has been no construction, and this school was not on the priority list for 2009. My question to the Minister is, was there ever a plan to build this school in Porter's Lake?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I mean, we are committed to that school. Originally, it was a renovation, but it's been turned into a new construction. There has been a delay there. It turned out that the preferred site had considerable wetlands, and so there had to be negotiations with the Department of Natural Resources to provide wetlands in lieu of that area. And there was also a problem around a neighboring trail system. So we're working through those issues, and the final sort of delay has been a request from HRM to put some community enhancements into the building, so we're trying to work through that, and we're hoping to be able to move into the final design and hopefully start construction in the spring. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Preston on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This school has been promised for a long time, and I'm pleased to hear that the Minister is committed to continue with this project. And will the other school in the Chesuncook area, the small school in that area, close at the same time?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Yeah, I understand that the new school will replace two schools in that region. I don't have the names of those particular schools, but certainly they will not close until the students have been transferred into the new building. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Preston on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, Nova Scotia has been promised various schools and renovations for years. School boards' priority lists haven't been listened to by the previous government, and it's set their own agenda. Then they fail to complete the projects as promised in a timely manner. My question to the Minister is, will the Minister clarify what schools the government plans to build over its mandate and when they plan to have them open?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm not clear if the Honourable Member is asking for a complete list of the capital construction projects, and I provided that information during budget estimates, and I'd certainly be pleased to table that information. I don't have the budget information with me today, but certainly I provided that detail during the budget estimates, and certainly would be pleased to offer it again. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question through you is to the Minister of Energy. The recent $4.75 billion deal between Hydro-Quebec and New Brunswick Power has alarmed many within Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador, Maine, New England states, and justifiably so. The details of the deal are coming out and more, and it looks like Hydro-Quebec could dictate energy prices for eastern North America. The hopes of bringing clean energy from Lower Churchill Falls Project to Nova Scotia and through it is in possible jeopardy because it may be carried through the Hydro-Quebec grid. Mr. Speaker, to the Minister, when were you aware of the negotiations between Quebec and New Brunswick Ministers of Energy, and what measures did you take to ensure the protection of Nova Scotia's energy interest in that process?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you for the question, Member. I appreciate the little activity. And thank you, Mr. Speaker, for recognizing me. I had the opportunity this fall, as the previous minister is aware, to attend an Energy Ministers Conference in St. John's, Newfoundland. During the exchanges that were held at that time with Minister Dunderdale and Minister Keir, actually, I believe is the correct way to pronounce his name, and, of course, we were also joined by ministers from other parts of the region. Richard Brown was there from Prince Edward Island. We had an opportunity at length to discuss some of the possibilities in the future of things that we could be addressing. At no time was there any discussion on this particular matter. And if I may, and I know you're going to allow me, thank you, Mr. Member, I want you to know that when this piece of news reached my office, my first reaction, of course, it was as someone who grew up on the Chantremar Marsh, the concern about the fact that this is an important and tough decision to have been made. There are implications for our province, because after all, when we solve problems in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island, or Newfoundland, Labrador, we're discussing regional issues. That's the concern that the Premier, I'm sure, will be taking forward to the conference that will be held in the Lower Churchill in the next few months, and it's something that I'm looking forward to seeing what his report back to me will be on.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North on your first supplementary.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. As the Minister would know, Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and Labrador's energy interests may now be negatively affected. The significance of this energy deal with the province of Quebec makes Premier Graham, the pupil of Joey Smallwood, unbroken energy deals with Hydro-Quebec. This deal and the reluctance to grant an energy corridor for transmission could effectively cut Nova Scotia out of the New England market. Anyone can see that Hydro-Quebec's energy intentions are to become the dominant, if not sole, energy force within Eastern Canada. My question, what discussions have you had with the executives from Emera Nova Scotia Power to ensure that they're not engaged in talks with Hydro-Quebec regarding even partial ownership of our dominant energy supplier here in Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you to the member opposite. And again, I would like to reinforce the fact that those discussions are ongoing things which we're going to be discussing in the department. And one of the issues that I want to be very clear on, and I, as soon as I found this out, I was aware of the Acts of 1992, and I think it's for the member, not that particular member isn't aware of this, but for other members of the House, an important Nova Scotia Power Privatization Act introduced at that time very clearly restricted that non-resident ownership could not exceed 15%. That is a real concern because, as the Deputy Premier has said, as the Premier has said, we in this province want to make sure that we in this province are in control of the energy supply. And I would like to table that act from 1992, if I may.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton North on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Emera is a publicly traded company, and there's no denying that Hydro-Quebec is in a financial position to take a stake in Emera. Hydro-Quebec will certainly be engaged, if they're not already engaged, in discussions with Emera, as they now want to move their energy into northeast United States via Bangor Hydroelectric Company. Mr. Speaker, my question through you to the Minister, what results have yielded in any discussions between Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and Labrador, either Premier Williams or his minister, regarding a transmission corridor for the Lower Churchill project through Nova Scotia, both entering Nova Scotia and leaving Nova Scotia to the New England states, thereby negating Hydro-Quebec's possible dominance over the regional grid.
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, and thank you to the member opposite. It's always a pleasure to have conversations on the importance of a regional grid and the fact, of course, that we have to share these issues regionally. Let me assure the member opposite, the Lower Churchill proposition gives us many opportunities. You know, unfortunately, from my perspective as a New Brunswicker of many years in the past, Hydro-Quebec has now changed the water on the beans, if it's appropriate to say at this time, because they are now, as neighbours of ours, we're going to have to continue to make sure that we work with Hydro-Quebec if the deal does go through. The concern, of course, that we have is that we want to make sure regionally we solve the issue. I know the Premier will bring that concern to the Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, and I want to be assured that Richard Brown from Prince Edward Island and Kathy Dunderdale from Newfoundland are people that I have a great deal of faith in, because we want to make sure that Nova Scotia's interests are a top priority. But thank you for the question. You've made my day.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, sheriffs in the province work very hard to ensure the safety and security of the public. They provide court security and they safely escort prisoners, among other services. Concerns have been raised that the Department of Justice has not kept up with staffing needs in the Sheriff Division. So my question to the Minister of Justice and Attorney General is, would the Minister please report to the House what the current staffing levels are in the Sheriff's Department?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you for the question to the Honourable Member. Mr. Speaker, I believe that the numbers, I don't have them right here in front of me right at the moment, but I believe in the last couple of years there's been about 20 to 30 added positions to sheriffs, and at the present time I do know, having discussions with my staff, that the staffing complement of the sheriffs is in a stable condition, so I'm quite confident that there's sufficient resources there, and we're always continually looking at ways of how we improve the quality and delivery of service and ensuring that the services are positioned in the right places.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it's been brought to our attention that there are applications for new sheriffs that are on hold and that appointments are still sitting on the Deputy Minister's desk since the change of government took place. In fact, Mr. Speaker, it seems that the High Sheriff is having problems filling shifts and is having to bring in sheriffs from out of town throughout the province elsewhere at times due to lack of sufficient staff. In one particular instance, a person was told that they were to be hired for the position, but once the NDP took over, everything was put on hold and that the status hasn't changed over the last 4 months. My question to the Minister is, how many vacant positions are there in Sheriff Services and how many positions have been filled since you've assumed the position of Minister of Justice?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
I'd like to thank the Honourable Member for the question. I'm quite satisfied with the staffing levels, and the concerns that he raises have not been brought to my attention in that manner. In fact, I had assurances that the Sheriff's Department have appropriate resources, and any vacancies that may be there, the normal staffing processes are intact, and we'll let the process take care of itself. But I want to assure this House that there's no positions resting on my desk that are being waiting for signature.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and hopefully the Minister of Justice can find time to speak to his Deputy Minister and find out if she might have some applications sitting on her desk which have not been signed off on. Mr. Speaker, Nova Scotians learned of some of the obscene overtime being paid to some of the nurses in Capital District due to nursing shortages. The concern here is that a lack of sheriffs is once again going to cause overtime and extra travel when they're having to be brought in from other parts of the province due to staffing shortages. changes. Speaker, we know the important role sheriff play in court security, and just 2 weeks ago in a Halifax courthouse, a man threatened a Crown attorney in the middle of a hearing. So, Speaker, we need to ensure that our justice system is working properly and that the security of everyone involved in it is being protected, especially with the proper complement of sheriffs. So my final supplementary to the Minister is, will the Minister commit to providing this House with the details as to whether there are any shortages that exist within sheriff services in Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
I want to thank the member for his question. Mr. Speaker, I just want to talk a moment on the Sheriff's Department, that I have all the confidence that that they're doing an excellent job. The in conjunction with the Deputy Minister's position, I can assure him that nothing sits on her desk, and anything that needs to be brought forward to me is done in a very timely manner, and I have great confidence in the service that she provides. Concerning the Sheriff's Department, I'm also very confident with the quality of service and the director that's within that department. And concerning the issue of vacancies and its pattern, we can get him that information, but I'm very confident that it's in a very stable position.
The Honourable Member for Argyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question through you to the Minister of Health. I've taken the opportunity on a number of occasions to talk and ask questions about the long-term care facility in my constituency, Nikhil Home for Special Care. I thank the Minister for the meeting that we had with Administrator Bertha Brannan on September 9th, but since that meeting, the tenders for the 22-bed expansion expired, and there's been no correspondence since September 3rd. Mr. Speaker, could the Minister update the House on this very important long-term care project?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for the question. And Mr. Speaker, indeed, I did have an opportunity to meet with the Honourable Member and the Administrator for the home. Mr. Speaker, the Continuing Care Strategy has allocated additional allotments for beds for that particular home. They're needed in that community. And, Mr. Speaker, my department and myself, this government, are committed to work with that particular facility and with the Honourable Member to see how we can achieve what he desires and what we desire, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Argyle on your first supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and that's what the community desires. Mr. Speaker, the Board of Directors and Administrator do feel a little abandoned right now. There's been no correspondence, there's been no phone calls, no email. Do you think that the department might want to let Nikhil know what the next steps are? Mr. Speaker, my question, or, you know, could the minister commit to writing a letter to Nikhil Home to give them an idea what the, if they're still on the list for the 22-bed expansion, and if so, what are the next steps?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, if they have any confusion about what the next steps can or should be, I would be happy to communicate with them to bring some clarity to them on this. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Argyle on your final supplementary.
Again, thank you very much, and I thank the Minister for the answer. And like I've been saying, that they haven't received an answer since September 3rd. So even past the time that we had the meeting on September 9th, there really has been no follow-up from her department. So they are feeling a little left out in the cold right now. They don't know whether they still have a project or not. So, Mr. Speaker, will the Minister, and actually, Mr. Speaker, that they've spent about $600,000 to get to this point today, with the tendering, with the well, and all the stuff that they've been needed to do to get the project going. But now that there's nothing really going on, Nikhil's worried about the loan that they took out to cover these costs. So, Mr. Speaker, will the minister also, in her letter, commit to ensuring that the department will help cover the servicing costs on the loan while the project is in limbo?
The Honourable Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as I indicated in my earlier response to the member, Mr. Speaker, we would like to see the additional beds added to this facility and this community, and we're more than happy to continue to work with that particular operator to see what it is that we can achieve for the community and for our continuing care strategy, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Bedford-Birch Cove.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A story last week in the Chronicle Herald reported that several bridges in Halifax Regional Municipality are in dire need of repair, Mr. Speaker. These are not the only examples of aging bridge infrastructure in the province. While some of these bridges may not be under the jurisdiction of the province, the safety and maintenance of all our bridges should be a top priority for government. Mr. Speaker, a Statistics Canada paper from 2008 indicated that Nova Scotia has the second oldest bridge infrastructure in the country. My question to the Minister, what is the government's plan to renew the unacceptable state of Nova Scotia's bridges?
Who's your question to a member?
The Minister of Infrastructure Renewal.
Okay. The Honourable Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal.
Thank you. Thank you. The encouragement from the member from Cape Breton South, I don't need at this stage. It's an important question in bridges across the province and how I travel to work. I travel, of course, across an overpass that's of some importance some days as you come down the Quinpool Road. However, the concern that we have and the important issue that I want the member to understand is that we do have bridge inspectors, and the bridges that they are responsible for, each and all of them are inspected each and every year, but in a different way. We can talk about further at a time where I can explain it more thoroughly, but I do appreciate the question.
The Honourable Member for Bedford-Birch Cove on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it's often difficult for Nova Scotians to get information regarding the maintenance of bridges. If this information were readily available online, it would be easier for the average person, maybe cut down on a little red tape. So my question to the Minister, will you make completed bridge inspections by your department available online?
The Honourable Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal.
Thank you to the member opposite, and you never answer a question yes or no. It's for the young member opposite. I want him to know. The issue comes down to the fact that with 20 bridge inspectors, they're out there doing their job. Now, if I'm going to ask them as a minister to take the time to file reports to make sure all that paperwork is done on time, I'm taking them away from the job that they are most important to do, out there in the field doing their work each and every day. If we were going to do this online, the problem would be, of course, we'd probably have to hire extra staff. Someone is concerned about a bridge.
Order, please. The time for oral question period has expired.
This podcast was previously aired on Legislative Television. The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.